So I'm going to be talking about robustness in the Drosophila singularity network. So the singularity network functions in Drosophila embryogenesis to specify the segments along the anterior posterior axis. And it functions at the end of a cascade of developmental regulatory networks, starting with the maternal genes like Bicoid and Nanos, which really start to define the anterior posterior axis. So looking at an embryo here, there's an anterior and a posterior end, and there are these gradients, and these set up. Is that better? Any better? Okay. So these gradients of maternal genes set up domains of expression of gap genes, which in turn define the actual 14 body segments in the embryo. And the segment polarity genes, which is what I'll be discussing, function after this point. They basically define the boundaries between the segments and also specify the anterior versus the posterior end of each segment. So here in a photo I took from Galea et al. Is an actual picture of the expression of the segment polarity genes. There are two key regulators here. In brown is staining for the engrailed protein. This is one of the regulators that is expressed at the anterior end of each segment. And then in blue is staining for wingless mRNA. Wingless is expressed at the posterior end. So basically here is one segment unit and it repeats 14 times across the embryo. And so you can see that these two are, you know, opposed directly next to each other, which is an important part of how the pattern forms. And so, as I said, this is a well-studied model genetically. And in 2000, Van Dassen and Odell published a Nature paper where they described a mathematical model of this. And this is my sort of representation of their model. So wingless here is one of those two regulators, and engrailed here is the other. So in this model, the ovals basically represent mRNA, and the squares proteins, and then edges are interactions, and they can be, for instance, here, engrailed mRNA produces engrailed protein by transcription, but then the effects of proteins on mRNA, like here, this is a repression of transcription. So those are most of the interactions that are going on here. So there's this wingless protein which serves as a transcriptional regulator in the cell where it's produced and is also secreted as an intracellular signal. And then engrailed here is a transcription factor that controls production of another intracellular signal, hedgehog. So secreted wingless and hedgehog are the two important intracellular signals here. And cubitus interruptus is another transcription factor. And it, in particular, has two forms. There's the full-length form of the protein, which is an activator. You can see it activates a number of genes. And then it's cleaved to form this repressive form. This is basically, it cuts off the activation domain. It now acts as a repressor. And it represses many of the targets of the full-length activator and possibly some others as well. And this is regulated by PATCHD, which is the receptor for the hedgehog signaling. So those are the sort of major genes that we're going to talk about here. And their model basically looked at levels of these mRNA and protein species in each cell on a lattice to try to look at how it would form the segment polarity pattern. So wingless is a secreted protein, and both in their model and it's pretty clear experimentally, it has two separate roles. One of them before secretion is to activate its own transcription in a manner that's not dependent on processing and secretion. So it's independent of genes. I think gooseberry is one of these that are necessary for its secretion. But then, yeah, it also has a secreted it's also secreted, and in the secreted form, it serves as a signal. And they sort of omitted this and collapsed it, but the frizzled receptor binds it and it's transduced by armadillo, and that's an entirely separate effect that acts on a different set of genes. So everything. This is basically what the lattice is looking like. So you know these are cells, and then within a cell you have concentrations of mRNA and protein per cell. So you know there. This is actually a little bit bigger than their lattice, just to line up with the picture. But within each cell, there's a concentration of each one of the mRNA and proteins on there. So you know, all of these things inside the cell, for each cell in that lattice. No, those are dynamic variables in the model. So, so what they're basically doing, get to that. So on this lattice, so for the intracellular things, they're basically taking place in each of these. For the intracellular signals, their way of looking at processes like diffusion is to say that sort of on each cell face, there is a concentration of each of these secreted factors, and they can, and there are transport processes that let them move around between cell faces and diffuse along, basically diffusion along the edges in the lattice. And so that's how they're looking at diffusion of intracellular signals. And for a lot of things, including both hedgehog and wingless, that's probably not an unreasonable model, since hedgehog, for instance, actually has a lipid anchor that holds it in a membrane always, and wingless doesn't have a lipid anchor, but it's modified with sugar groups that hold it in the extracellular matrix. And in fact, wingless signaling is dependent on proper wingless signaling is dependent on the right kind of extracellular matrix. It's not drawn on here, but all of these things, both intracellularly and extracellularly, are degraded as well. I'll get into more detail about that when we look at the exact model. So in their model, they have 32 dynamic variables per cell. Basically, there are the intracellular concentration of these species, as well as things on the face of each cell, the secreted proteins. And then their lattice unit was 16 cells they were looking at, which gives you a lot of dynamic variables in the model. And furthermore, they had basically 50 parameters left in the model, even after they did various things to reduce them. So you're left with 50 parameters in these 12 different ordinary differential equations. And we don't have, I think, any sense of these values for really any of them. And so the approach they took was to look at random parameter values. So they would take a parameter set by basically picking a random value for each of these 50 parameters and running their simulation on it. And so what they found is that basically 0.5% of their parameter sets would form the segment clarity pattern in the way they were looking for, and you know these are their conclusions that this indicates the system is somehow robust to parameter variation. So the idea is that if you have 50 parameters, then the fact that you can find, you know, picking random values for each of 50 different things that you can find a range where it works at all, especially this 0.5%, the 1 in 200. Means that it's robust. I mean, there's no maybe way to quantify that, but So I mean, what I want to do, so they conclude this, but I don't think they have a lot of intuition in their paper about why it behaved this way. And so what I was interested in doing is trying to understand what's going on in their model that gives it pattern formation, and trying to understand also a few ways in which their model doesn't work exactly right, and see if I could fix those. Pardon? A couple of things I'll get to that I think they didn't do exactly. Parameter variation here. So the first thing they did was they took lots of random parameter values and showed that a large fraction of random values would work. They also sort of picked one parameter set that worked and systematically varied parameters and showed that for many parameters, And for all of them, there's some, you know, significant range over which they'll work. And some of them, it was completely insensitive to that parameter. In some, for some parameter sets, and the problem I think is that in different parameter sets, you know, you have different degrees of robustness. So for that kind of variation. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's
also a very weird result, right? Because why would you have robustness for a set of parameters? I mean, only one of the different parameters is the Wilson parameter. I'm imagining robustness around that point. But they're saying that there's a model by some weird chance not being complete.
Well, I think the
variation of a totally wrong for the parameters as well.
Well, so I think there are two reasons that you might think this is true. One of them is that this sort of robustness, right? If during development you have any sort of perturbation, even at different temperatures, you know, various rates are going to change substantially. And
I understand why you want to be robust on your set of parameters.
Yeah.
How you have this massive couple of differential equations and have a totally and have the model fit so that a totally different solution would also be robust.
And I think it's not right, and I think you know, the argument perhaps is that the way the network works, I mean that it is, I mean not designed obviously, but that the network is set up in a way that gives it this kind of robustness, and that's important for how the network could work, both because basically in the course of evolution to produce this network, evolution had to stumble across it, and if it only worked for one, you know, very carefully tuned set of parameters, then evolution in some sense never find it. I think it is maybe part of it.
One wants to go beyond stability, which is correct set of parameters and the function of the system. Here, when striving for the most conservative safety, you ask for a network. If a large sweet spot around the set of parameters.
Yeah.
And then the solution that you find almost half, almost the definition of half the solution is completely different set of parameters if you only use this around there. But there's just a correlation that comes from the structure of the network.
So it's locally stable as many things on some large amount of things. I think that's what I'm really
saying.
He's
saying it's locally stable right.
Yeah, I mean it's locally stable in the sense that it forms the pattern from their initial conditions, but you can certainly find initial conditions where it won't form the right pattern.
Addressing the global, I guess I would be much happier with a global measure if it were well defined. But here, you know, it's random.
Yeah, I mean, it's
the obvious problem is that the parameter domain is not compact, right? So, you know, if I change the cutoff, the number is going to change.
Yeah.
So the number is frequency.
Right. I think their argument, at least, is that sort of on the upper end, for a lot of their parameters, there's a limit in which, you know, if the parameter becomes big enough or small enough or whatever, the interaction is meaningless. Yeah, exactly. Saturation effects are.
You know, before I'm close to number.
Right. Yeah.
There ought to be a way of defining somehow sensible compact domain parameters, but that hasn't happened.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree that there isn't necessarily. I think it's not that it's enormous, but that it's ill-defined is the problem, that there is no. So to get their model to work when they figured all these interactions out by going to the literature on on segment clarity patterning, and there are, you know, thousands of papers on this, and they trying to figure out the interactions in this network that they should include in their model. And there are actually two interactions they didn't initially include, but they added, and adding these was actually important to make the network work, that it didn't work without these interactions. And one of them is actually this intracellular feedback of wingless protein under its own expression. And that is something that I think that the experimental evidence for that is pretty strong, that that happens. But adding that was necessary to make the thing work. And the other thing is the suppression of engrailed by cubitus interruptus. And this is, I think, less well established experimentally. And I don't think actually that it's exactly the right, was exactly the right change to make to the network. So I'm going to. So they, some of the experimental evidence was existed previous to their paper. I think that it's become much clearer after their paper than people, you know. Got the letters of the protein, yeah. From which? Right. Yeah. That would also. Right. There's the basically because I mean there isn't evidence for that interaction. I think it is the basic. So in looking at the model, this is the basic form of the interactions they use. I think this is pretty common in doing this sort of modeling. But so the sort of equation for transcription here, there's basically this first order decay of all the components, and they're all scaled in a way so that at maximum expression you get, you know, unit one for the amount of mRNA and for protein. And translation here is just linear, and transcription, the effect of a transcriptional activator is it has a sigmoidal form where there's some k term that's sort of like an affinity, and it tells you how much you need for half maximal activation. And there's a nu, which is a cooperativity like Michael was talking about yesterday, in terms of just defining how steep the slope is. Regulation?
Right.
Right. No. I think that a lot. I don't think that the translational delay plays a major role in the equations. And you could I didn't go through and do this, but I suspect that you could suppress that. And though there is one point is that one of the protein has post-translational control, right? The cleavage. So you might need to think a little bit about how to do that if you're doing that. But for the most part, that's probably true. In this equation, it's just because of the way that protein levels are rescaled, so that the they're basically they're rescaling protein levels, and then they're taking that constant and using that to so that at maximal I mean you're just ignoring, right? I mean you're getting rid of a dimensional constant. That's right. Yes. Okay. So so the rescaling, so what they do is they rescale mRNA levels so that at maximum levels of activation, the mRNA levels are 1, and they rescale protein levels so that at mRNA levels of 1, your protein levels are 1 at steady state, and that gets rid of the translation rate constant.
Okay.
No, because you do this per protein. Right, they have a rescaling per protein that sets the sort of level of, you know, the typical level, of, rather the maximal level of protein that you're going to see in the model, basically. So the sort of first task that they're looking at with their network, forming the pattern, is, you know, pretty straightforward looking. It's actually just this, and so I can talk a little bit about the experimental evidence for what's going on. So there's a pre-pattern that is expressed as a result of the pair rule genes that are sort of the thing directly upstream of the segment polarity genes. And they drive Lindlison and Grayled expression. And you can see this experimentally because even if you have mutations that completely abolish the segment polarity pattern, what you'll get is this pre-pattern will turn off and it'll fade away. So there's some pre-pattern that's established independent of the segment polarity genes, and then the segment polarity genes function to maintain the pattern. And there's actually something slightly more complicated that happens with cell proliferation that I'll talk about later. But to start out with, you're looking just at the idea that you can maintain these stripes of Lindlison and Grayled expression, which seems like it should be a pretty easy thing for the network to do. And the, you know, the way it could do it is by basically having three, you know, if you think about single cells, the idea is that you want to look at what behavior is going on in each cell. So that you can get away from having, you know, 512 variables in this huge model. So you think about each cell and, you know, wingless and engrailed expression basically being bistable would give you the kind of behavior that you want. So you ask this, and looking at the model, it turns out to be slightly more complicated than that, but not a lot. Basically, wingless actually acts this way, so that you start with wingless expression, you keep it, and if you start with none, you don't get any. But here, engrailed expression requires permissive signaling from wingless, basically. So if you have engrailed expression, you need wingless signaling to keep it on, otherwise it fades away. But importantly, and it isn't shown here, if you have a cell that doesn't start with engrailed expression, wingless signal won't turn on engrailed. So it's a permissive signal if you already have wingless. And if you just ask the question, so you have the parameter sets that they guess that determine, and you determine two things. You determine whether they form the pattern right, and you determine whether they basically follow these rules. What you can see is, and you can classify them based on that. For instance, here's the percentage of parameter sets that forms the pattern and has those behaviors and so forth. And what you can see is that if they form the pattern, they essentially always have those behaviors when you simulate just single cells outside of the lattice. And there's one exception here, which is just a question of the time point at which they stop their simulation. It doesn't maintain the pattern, but it loses it very slowly. So it scores as positive in the test. And then it also seems to explain, in some sense, most of what's going on. In other words, following these single cell behaviors is strongly predictive of actually forming the pattern. So what you do is, so this, you know, you generate, I think this is 10,000 parameter sets, and you test two things. You test, does it form the pattern right? And you use to categorize it here. And you ask, does it follow those single cell behavior rules when you simulate single cells, like I showed before? Categorize it here. So what you see is, for instance, 0.52% of those parameters form the pattern and have the right single cell behavior. 0.57% don't form the pattern, but they have that behavior and so forth. Is that? So you generate parameter sets and you classify them in those two ways, and you know, you put them in one of four boxes based on that, and you count. Pardon? So Sorry, I can't.
These are all common.
Yeah, so these are generated the same way that they generated their random parameters. I don't think that these are actually the exact set of 10,000 they used in there.
So they're saying these are the best set of parameters to come up with, and half the spells can be used in the right thing.
No, sorry, so these are 10,000 different random parameter sets chosen in the random way that they chose random parameters.
It's almost a
Yes. Right. And. Well, so sorry. This. Right. This number here. This is the 0.5% from before. Yes. Yeah. I mean, so as I said, it's one parameter set, and I actually looked at it manually. And what happens is that when they do their simulation, there's a time cutoff that they use to say, you know, we're going to look at the pattern at this point and see if it worked. And it looks like it works at that time point, but if you take it out twice as long, it actually doesn't. It is basically, it's very slow to lose it, and so that's what that one is. These numbers add up to 100%, basically. These are percents, and then these are just column and row sums for those to look at fractions. So they add up to 100. Well, I mean, it's rounded. I mean, it's rounded to.
The one plus 3 points.
Yeah, this is 98.9. Yeah. So it looks like these single cell behaviors are basically a result of sort of bistability in these gene expression networks, and then there's the idea that positive feedback in these networks could produce bistability, and sort of just a schematic of how.
Bistability is
not state. Yes.
And on top of that, you need to see the neighbor
interactions. Yeah. Right. Cell signaling. Yeah. Yeah. So just thinking about sort of the behavior within one cell, whether you can get bistability. So what you see is that there is positive feedback in both of these for both of these transcriptional regulators, and furthermore, the interactions they added are, you know, each one is a key component of the positive feedback. So I think that you know, at least suggests that the positive feedback is going to be important for producing this behavior. And then the idea is that then there's that positive feedback then in other parts of the network, you know, wingless signal also affects in Grail. And so that's how, yeah. So what happens is in Grail, in the situation where you have wingless signal, it's permissive for in Grail expression, but right, if you start with in Grail and you have wingless signal, you keep it on. But if you start with no in Grail and get wingless signal, you don't turn on in Grail. So you still need bistability. You still need the cell to remember whether it started with engrailed expression or not.
So the space you have, your original space, you have wingless.
Yeah.
Right, and you have engrailed free space.
Yeah.
And it becomes engrailed with hedgehog.
With hedgehog, yeah. And so
but according to this model, hedgehog takes on automatically engrailed.
Right. Yeah.
You said according to the model, that
no, you need, sorry, you need wingless to maintain in Grail expression. So, and I can go back, but, so what you actually have here is that if you start with in Grail expression and you have wingless signal, you keep in Grail expression on, and then you also turn on hedgehog, which is just a result of having in Grail expression. You also have hedgehog here. You start with in Grail expression. It's a question is you lose in Grail expression if you don't have wingless signaling. Right, but it's not enough. That's the point. So, yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, what basically happens here is that you have this, but it isn't strong enough. You also need this signal. Yes. Yeah. So, No.
So, you were saying that there's something you can upregulate in this positive feedback and make things very well to the general rule?
When you get transient, you probably get to tell them.
It doesn't.
You get transient to all those.
Yeah, so.
Go on transient and then become a wall.
So one, I guess, experimental test of this is that you can express engrailed in the wrong places, and what you see is basically if you drive engrailed expression everywhere using this a heat shock promoter on engrailed and heat shock the embryos, then at a later time point what you see is you see an extra stripe of engrailed on the other side of the wingless expressing stripe. So that's some evidence that there's that sort of positive feedback that I can draw it out of that. So that's at least some evidence for that sort of. Yeah.
Are all these known systems, everything on your known
system? Yes. Yeah. So these are things that people started in sort of the mid to late 80s studying the segment clarity pathway, and the interactions here are things that they pulled out of the literature to. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not. No, I agree. It's not complete parameter insensitivity. I'll get to that actually in a minute. Yeah. So it does. I mean, and what happens? It turns. And yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, yeah, I'll get to that. I mean, you can look at it closely and it actually shows what's.
Why didn't they put, you know, ribosome synthesis brain, and why didn't they put cell cycle proteins and all that?
Well, I mean, I think that all of these at some level, right, if you write down sort of the easiest phenomenological equations you can for the network, it has those 50 parameters. And so, and, I mean, I don't think they were trying to inflate them.
The only ones that are important are the ones they added ad hoc.
Not the only ones that are important. I mean, if you get rid of some of the other interactions, you also make the network not work. This is just the dotted lines are things they had to add in addition to their existing model to make it work. I think any of the interactions in those positive feedback loops and some others as well are important to make it work. So, so looking at bistability in their model, this is, you know, slightly expanded form of that transcriptional equation I showed earlier. And so what you have, mRNA produces wingless protein, then wingless protein feeds back to control wingless expression. Here you have the translation, you know, very simple term, and then here you have some basal level of mRNA expression and then also activation by intracellular wingless, and you can do basically phase plane analysis to understand what's going on, which I can go through in more detail if anyone is curious. If anyone wants to. Yeah, okay, yeah. Then sort of what you end up with is, so the actual, actually, so the, as I talked about, the fate of wingless protein is slightly more complicated. You know, you produce wingless protein, it's degraded as well, and there are these transport terms where it can be secreted And then once it's secreted, it can diffuse around the cell and diffuse away to other cells and move around. But it turns out all of these processes are linear in their equation. So you can basically solve for the steady state level of intracellular wingless at a given level of wingless mRNA. And then you can compare that to this, which is basically a term for how much of it you need to drive expression, and ask, you know, if I have high wingless mRNA, will I make enough protein to keep wingless mRNA high? And so this is some complicated combination of parameters. And this is, you know, a single parameter, and this parameter doesn't show up here because these are all transport and decay rates. And what you can do is to look at these. So this is plotting, you know, this combination of parameter values and this one parameter value that's the amount you need for transcriptional activation. So this is in their random parameter sets. And then if you restrict your cells to just ones that form the pattern right, you can see they basically all obey the inequality that you predict from the bifurcation analysis. In other words, they all have the high wingless stable state in the cell. And you can do this for the other stable states you need as well. And when you do that, you can then come up with this, which is, now this is purely looking at the parameters, a static test of whether they have the right stable, you know, the right fixed points in a single cell. And you can see is that this is basically a necessary condition. I mean, it's not perfect, and that's probably because approximations in trying to restrict it to sort of what's going on in a single cell. But then it's also not very sort of predictive in the sense that a lot of things have the right fixed points but don't actually form the pattern right. Presumably what's going on is they have the right fixed points but they're not getting there from the initial condition. So looking at the initial condition, you remember, I mean, it looked like it's really sort of set up to go there. The initial condition is very similar to the final one, but that's because you're only looking at two of these genes, that engrailed and wingless. If you look at some of the other ones, in their model, they start with none of it at all. But if you look at actual Drosophila embryos, first of all, there's basal expression of these components, like cubitus interruptus and patched, across the embryo before this turns on. So it's not actually the most biologically realistic pre-pattern. And also, obviously, starting with those things as zero, they aren't zero in the actual desired pattern. So you're sort of further from the final state where you want to be in. So you can modify the pre-pattern to make it sort of more biologically reasonable and also more likely to form the right pattern. When you do that, you can see that a lot of these parameter sets, so these are just looking at the same parameter sets, a lot of the things that here had the right fixed points but don't form the pattern go to here, where they now have the right, they now actually do form the right pattern from the modified initial condition. So it looks like that's sort of some of what was going on. So the other thing that they didn't look at all in their initial model is what happens to the system when you have cell proliferation. So in some sense, this is where I think the more interesting parts of this model come in. So here, looking at proliferation just in this lattice model, you know, you take it, you make it twice as wide, and you copy the state of each cell. And obviously what you get is these wide stripes. And what happens if you look at actual embryos is that these wide stripes become narrower. So, cell division. So the stripes become narrower, so they you know, really just define the boundaries between segments. So what will happen is you start out with a segment that's actually just like four cells wide, and by the end of the stage of embryogenesis, this is important, it'll be 16 to 20 cells wide, but these stripes will remain quite narrow.
It doesn't worry about the stability.
I don't think that a lot of tests have been done of that sort of thing. I mean, I'm sure that if you look at pictures of embryos, obviously the boundary kind of moves around a little bit.
Yeah.
So in the so in their models, they actually use, they don't, you know, their lattice has height as well as width, right? So they have multiple cells tall because of their model is totally deterministic, and it starts out with symmetry. I mean, it's never, you never lose that symmetry. So, I believe they did, yeah.
So
they had. I mean, this actually isn't so, but yeah, no, I agree, it's much longer. Well, it's true, but I mean, most of the primary sets do go wrong in various ways, so. Right. So, right. So this is what happens. And this is basically, this is what happens immediately after proliferation. So before you let the dynamics go after proliferation, this is what you want. But right, it isn't going to be what you get.
There's no evidence for ingrained
wingless feedback. So you mean signaling from engrailed to wingless? There is some evidence, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. Right. So what you want is, yeah, and what you basically want is you want the same sort of dependence that you have for engrailed here, so that wingless requires basically a permissive hedgehog signal. So hedgehog doesn't turn on wingless, but it maintains it. It's needed to maintain it if it's already on. And that's something that there's some experimental evidence for. And so the question is, you know, are there ways to modify their model to make that happen? So if you're looking at so here again, the network with the positive feedbacks, and then in green is the way that hedgehog signaling impinges on the network. And so here you can see the problem is that hedgehog signaling is supposed to be mediated by Cubitus interruptus. But Cubitus interruptus sort of also serving a role in working with engrailed, so it can't, you know, serve two masters at the same time. Or at least if it does, it requires a lot of fine-tuning to do that. And that's the reason that in their model, the hedgehog signaling isn't able to control wingless expression the way it should. And so what I wanted to do is basically look at this and also some recent experimental evidence and figure out how to change their model to make it work better, to make it have particularly feedback. And so the change I made, which maybe this looks kind of dramatic, but basically you take Cubitus interruptus and you get rid of its effects on engrailed, so that all it's doing is transducing the hedgehog signal. And then here you add this other gene, sloppy paired, which has a role in engrailed regulation that was discovered fairly recently. It was published in 2003 by Alexander and Vincent. So what they found is that engrailed represses sloppy paired, which in turn represses engrailed, so it's fulfilling the same role that Cubitus interruptus did. The reason that it wasn't discovered initially is that it's actually there are two sloppy paired genes that have completely overlapping function in embryogenesis, so you couldn't pick it up by mutation. So it wasn't identified until much later using different kinds of techniques. The idea is that it could play this sort of role here, and that would rescue the model in terms of dealing right with cell division. So the other thing I can go back is, so they have this patch system which transduces the hedgehog signal. And I looked at it to some extent both ways, but basically collapsed that so that hedgehog acts directly here. Yeah. And that's.
I'm quite confused. Like, if you're saying then that that other paper, their argument that it's actually invalid, that you're just missing that conclusion.
I'm saying that. Yeah, that some of the.
But I mean, all those numbers about stability and all, and finding the right pattern 25 to 300 is going to be invalid.
I'm not saying it's random garbage, I'm saying that it's... Right, but I guess the thing is there are different ways to realize the same network structure, and in their making their model, they picked Cubitus Interruptus to be the neutral repression partner within Grail because they, I think, misinterpreted some data.
It's all based on some robustness property of these networks, right?
So right, and the point is that... Well, what you can do is you can change the labels on anything in the network you want to, and it has the same robustness properties. And, I mean, that's...
Look, there are models that are not robust, right? So, okay. So we can say, all right, get rid of those. But nobody said that there's a unique robust model. No. No. None of our kind likes to present it as, intuitive speed for robustness. What would you want to call it? But this model is robust. It happens to be pretty insightful about picking a bunch of thoughts, and they pick nice models. But I don't think there is any vaguely rigorous statement that they use for about thoughts. Obviously, you can pick all sorts of redundant doubts. If you have one robust model, you have to put it more.
And I think the other... Yes, they did. They did some comparison of their model results with mutant analysis. Like I said, the particular problem they had was related to this Cubitus Interruptus protein, and it's problematic because the allele that was first identified for it wasn't a loss-of-function allele. It was a strange gain-of-function allele. And I think that's complicated a lot of the analysis. And if you read the papers, as late as the time they were making this, I think it wasn't settled how that was, how that was going to play out. Right.
So yes. There's many other ways of detecting models.
Slightly complicated because those exact results are what they used to write down the to figure out the interactions in the first place, right? So in that sense, it's hard to come up with independent tests. I mean, certainly you can do some independent tests that people have done with later things where they take sort of cells and culture and look at things that way as well to try to get different and less genetic lines of evidence for these things. But
the goal is to get the right internal model.
Right, yes, no, I agree, yes. And...
So,
right.
So,
that's right. So if
what's happening with these two errors with opposite signs and the TI turning into TM? So this is the
So what happens is, right, so if there's no hedgehog signaling, you get repressive cubitus interruptus that turns off wingless. So that's why, in the absence of hedgehog signaling, you can't have wingless expression.
So the eye is unstable without hedgehog.
Right. Yeah. I think that's... Yeah, so in any case, so this new model works at least as well as their initial one for forming the right four-cell pattern. And then when you look at proliferation, you know, cell division by splitting things up, something like 1.7% of random parameter sets work, just generating them in the same way that they did. And so, and this, I think, sort of gets at the question you were asking. What's going on is basically hedgehog signaling is permissive for maintaining wingless expression. So when you have hedgehog, it blocks that transformation and you're left with activating cubitus interruptus. But then here, you know, this needs to be unstable so that you basically lose wingless expression when you lose hedgehog signaling and accumulate repressive cubitus interruptus. And then you can look at here basically asking this to be unstable in the same way that you asked for other things to be stable. And when you ask for it to be unstable, I mean, you're the same thing. You're solving for intercellular levels of wingless protein as a function of wingless mRNA levels, right? So you start with high levels of this, but you have this repressive form present. You want to make sure that it does this. In other words, that this isn't stable. Wingless expression isn't self-perpetuating in the presence of repressive cubitus interruptus. So the dynamics are somewhat important, and I'll get to that. But most of what I looked at wasn't looking at the dynamics, and it turns out that you can get most of what's going on without looking at the specific dynamics. I mean, I guess, where is dynamics important? So I think that you start at initial conditions that aren't the same as the final conditions, and I think that mostly where it's important is in figuring out whether your initial conditions are going to go to the right attractor, basically. Right? I mean, I think that dynamics in terms of the detailed sort of times of signaling between cells doesn't turn out to be a major factor. There's not a lot of time dependence. I think that's mostly a consequence of the way the patterning task. I mean, it's this patterning task. And Right, but that's, I mean, I don't know if you call that dynamics. What I'm actually looking at that seems to capture most of what's going on is looking at the steady state level that will be there, right? Because you have production, transport, and decay processes. So you can ask at steady state how much gets there. And that turns out to...
Well, the dynamics is okay.
I mean...
If I understand correctly, what the says is it's really a matter of domain of refraction.
Right.
Yeah. Refraction.
Yeah.
So you got your by stability.
Yeah.
And so the question is, if you start with the data, the CCAP, and all the things.
Yeah.
But then there is another level of dynamics related to proliferation.
Mm-hmm.
And in the thought of that can be dealt with adequate or probably adequate. So now you've got your complete pattern, you've got the right pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And now they can project the time,
yeah.
but the start ending cells,
mm-hmm.
and ask what is the equilibrium, what is the steady state pattern.
I see what you're saying. I guess because all of their model was taking place in basically this regular lattice and everything, the way I looked at it was more something to just copy it over and look at what it looked at like when you did that. So the question is, if I were to add cells in a way that was basically not you know completely synchronous, what would happen there?
Is that more visual rules?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No. I agree that. Yeah. So if I just, yes. Right. You know. I. Yeah. Yeah. No. I agree that if I did that and sort of had cells divide at random across the pattern, that I think that I would typically. Right. Right. Yeah. Right, and I think that's complicated, right? So they're using they're thinking of these as concentrations, not numbers of molecules, right? So you divide in half, you have half as much protein, half as much volume. And I guess if you really wanted to think about it, you could think about growth occurring in some continuous way. And that isn't something that I've looked at all, but you could certainly, if that was going on, then I think you wouldn't ever have a sort of discontinuous change in any of your concentrations. Right. Well, the nuclear volume, right, changes as you have DNA replication, so it's not, Right. Okay. It's true, and it's actually even more complicated than that, because when you're going to mitosis, you condense the chromosome and entirely turn off transcription. So there are clearly more complicated things that go on during cell division. Maybe that's where, having relatively stable proteins and looking at those dynamics is actually important, because that smooths everything out across that change. Yeah, no, definitely. Not just for that. Yeah. Yeah. So I guess I can just quickly go through. I think we sort of talked about most of this, that you can again look at, in this case, you're basically testing for the absence of the right fixed point, and that's necessary. And here, that isn't perfect. I think there are a couple of reasons for that we're talking about.
And
14%. So this is restricting myself to the parameter sets that form the right four cell pattern, and asking if they do cell proliferation right. Yeah. Andrew and Fisher.